This is The Takeaway. I'm Nancy Solomon, a reporter in the WNYC newsroom, in for Tanzina Vega all week.
This year is on track to be what LGBTQ advocates say is the worst year in terms of bills filed against LGBTQ people.
That was Kate Sawson, a reporter for The 19th, speaking on The Takeaway at the beginning of March. And in the weeks since that interview, multiple states have taken steps to limit the rights of their transgender residents, particularly trans youth. Earlier this week, the Arkansas State Legislature overrode a veto by Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson on House Bill 1570. The bill makes Arkansas the first state in the nation to criminalize gender-affirming procedures for transgender minors.
I wanted to express my own personal view that this is too extreme, it was too broad.
Following the final passage of the bill, Governor Hutchinson explained his veto on NPR.
It did not grandfather in those young people who are currently under hormone treatment. And so this really puts a very vulnerable population in a more difficult position. It sends a wrong signal to them.
The bill is one of more than 90 anti-transgender rights bills that have been put forward by Republicans in state legislatures this year. And health care for trans youth is one of the issues at the center of a number of these laws. Many others prohibit trans children from playing on sports teams that align with their gender identities. Governor Hutchinson himself signed off on an anti-trans sports bill last month. Now LGBTQ advocates are turning to legal challenges and increased pressure on business leaders to push back on this wave of legislation. But in the meantime, trans youth in these states are being left in an increasingly vulnerable position. Here with me now is Evelyn Rios Stafford, Justice of the Peace for District 12 in Washington County, Arkansas. She's also the only openly transgender elected official in the state of Arkansas. Evelyn, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Sasha Bookert, Senior Attorney for Lambda Legal in Washington, D.C. Sasha, great to have you with us as well.
Thanks, Nancy. Thanks for having me on the show.
So, Evelyn, let's start with you. You met with Governor Hutchinson prior to his veto of HB 1570. How did that meeting come about, and what did you talk with him about?
Yeah, when I started the week last week, I really didn't expect to be meeting with the governor, but it was set up by one of our local state legislators here in Northwest Arkansas, Nicole Clowney, set it up because she felt that the governor, before he made a decision, should hear from the actual voices of trans people, because in the debate leading up to the bill, the voices of trans people and their families had really been sidelined in the whole debate. And so his office agreed to a meeting. But I also knew I'm 48. I'm not a trans youth. I was in high school 30 years ago. So I talked my way into bringing a young trans person with me. Her name's Willow Brashears. She is 18 years old, and she went through, came out as at 13 and went through the very process that this bill now bans.
Well, it must have felt incredibly good to have that kind of access to the governor, and then he actually vetoed the bill. So that must have been wonderful, but he hasn't been exactly reliable on trans issues, has he?
No, he hasn't. And we talked about that a little bit in the meeting. You know, one of the things that I really have to give him credit for is, you know, he wasn't trying to rush us out of the room or anything. He scheduled a 30-minute meeting, which was longer than we were expecting. And we actually went 10 minutes over because he had so many questions. I could tell in the meeting that this wasn't a topic that he was very familiar with at all. But he was, I feel that he was taking an honest effort, you know, to educate himself about, you know, trans issues. Some of his questions were very specific medical questions that I don't have the medical background to be able to answer. But we did talk about some of the other bills he signed because he asked at one point in the meeting, how the trans community is reacting to all this, because I think he started to see the pattern now that this legislature has been sending bill after bill after bill. There's even more bills on the way. I think there's 9 in all. And he didn't back down from signing the bills, but he did take my criticism of them into consideration. And I think, you know, I told him, for example, with the sports bill that I knew that, you know, the proponents of it were arguing that it was about fairness in sports. And what I told the governor, I said, if that's the case, why did that bill cover kindergartners? Because between kindergarten and puberty, for example, there really is no athletic difference between boys and girls. So to me, that kind of put the lie to what that bill was all about.
And what were the two of you able to tell him about the way that this bill is going, what impact it's going to have on trans youth in particular in Arkansas?
Yeah. You know, I think the governor learned that some of the talking points that the proponents of this bill have been putting forward are really distortions of what's actually happening. You know, they're fear-mongering that people are performing surgeries on young children and things like that. And that's really not happening in any way, shape, or form, and never would happen. You know, in fact, there are no surgeons who do anything like that in Arkansas. And, you know, I guess he fact that checked that and found that to be true, because he talked about that in his news conference. I think it was gratifying that he actually listened, because we found that when people actually listen to the real stories of trans people, you know, and you sit down with one of these young people, they're not a talking point anymore. They're a real living, breathing human being, you know, with a real story, and you can really start to understand the situation. And I think that's some of what happened.
I'm reminded, I can't help but be reminded of Harvey Milk, and who said, you know, in the 1970s, if gay people started coming out to the people they knew, life would change. And this is now the next iteration of that. That's really terrific to hear. So let's zoom out to the rest of the country now, Sasha. How does this latest anti-trans bill out of Arkansas compare to what we're seeing in other states?
Yeah, thanks, Nancy. Yeah, first I want to just thank Evelyn and all and the families in Arkansas that have been doing this amazing work, you know, to humanize trans people. There's such a need to humanize that we're human beings, and that, you know, we have, you know, we want to participate in our school systems, and we should be able to receive the same kind of care that other people receive. But yeah, this is, and we were paying attention obviously to the bills that have passed, but I think it's really, really important to remember that a lot of these bills are not passing thanks to the tireless advocacy of folks, you know, in the states. And yeah, unfortunately, you know, this is a year we've seen more and more anti-trans bills being introduced across state legislatures across the country. And there's a tremendous amount of work being done to defeat them. And most of them are being defeated. But it's just a very, very concerning moment for our community, for sure.
And when conservative governors like Governor Hutchinson veto some of these laws, what's driving those decisions? I mean, where are activists having success with some of these conservative Republican governors around the country?
Yeah, you know, I think, first of all, repeating what I just said, I think it's really important to underscore the importance of the work being done on the state level from people like Evelyn and the families there that are doing that work, and talking with the governor's office and having those person-to-person conversations. It's so important. I think another aspect of this is the law, you know, and it's really important to, you know, highlight a couple of things about this bill specifically, you know, that, you know, it's completely inconsistent with medicine first, the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is, you know, an organization of 67,000 pediatricians, you know, support this care for trans youth. As well as the Endocrine Society and so many other healthcare organizations. In fact, there's 18 states now that prohibit the kinds of exclusions that they want to implement. So it's completely inconsistent with actual science and medicine. You know, it's stigma and not science. But it's also violates the law. You know, you can't treat transgender people differently. These same treatments are provided for non-transgender people. And this clearly provides, you know, unequal protection. So I think that, you know, the governors that are vetoing this are firstly doing it because of their concern about the community, our community, after being, you know, after the humanization process. But I also think that, you know, they are concerned about litigation, and they should be, absolutely, because this completely violates medicine and law. And I will say that, you know, they are rightfully should be concerned about the impact, you know, that this is going to have with their business relationships. We've seen this, you know, in the past with HB2 in North Carolina, you know, when PayPal pulled out of the state because of the anti-trans bill there. And, you know, I think that, and that's right, you know, that, you know, A, there's a lot of LGBTQ people that work at these companies, but, you know, we're also, you know, consumers and have close business relationships. So I think that they should be deeply concerned about, you know, what's going to happen. I would love to see, you know, some response to the legislation, the anti-slate of hate being introduced in Arkansas, specifically from Walmart, you know, and other companies that do business there, because this is going to cause serious harm. You know, we'll litigate this and we'll prevail, but it's going to cause serious harm to trans youth and trans people in the interim, you know, while this moves through the courts. And it's just deeply concerning and reprehensible that, you know, they would focus on this issue when Arkansas and so many other states that are introducing these bills are almost last in the nation with regard to, you know, the healthcare they provide to their citizens and the economic well-being and other disparities.
Evelyn, what would have been some of the responses from the business community so far there?
You know, definitely some folks have started putting out, when the governor put out his veto, you know, there was a statement put out by Tom Walton of the Walton Family Foundation, you know, who's part of the Walton family, urging the governor to sustain the veto. We heard from the Northwest Arkansas Council basically saying the same thing. We've heard from Experience Fayetteville, which is focused on tourism in this area. Saying how bad this was going to be. So I think there is the consensus that this legislature is a little out of control with this and other issues as well. That's going to be bad for Arkansas in terms of business recruitment and tourism.
So Sasha, give us a sense of what are some of the legal challenges that you folks are mounting about against this legislation?
Well, you know, a similar bill was passed, an athletics bill, you know, a bill that would prohibit trans girls from participating in sports, K through 12 sports, was passed in the middle of the pandemic last June in Idaho. And it's not our case. The ACLU is litigating that in Idaho. And they were able to secure a preliminary injunction preventing that law from going into effect. And I thought, you know, the decision, if you take a minute to read it, it was really powerful in some ways, in that it clarified that this isn't about, you know, trans girls are girls, and, you know, they're not going to participate on a boys team, and, you know, barring them from playing sports and bonding with their peers and learning all those really important things you learn in athletics robs them of the ability to participate altogether. So, you know, that's one important case that, you know, is being appealed to the Ninth Circuit. And there's also a case that was brought in Connecticut, not in response to an anti-trans bill, but a bill trying to prohibit trans athletes from participating. And that's still moving its way through. You know, we haven't seen challenges filed in response to the bills that have been passed now. There's, you know, a bill that was passed in Tennessee as well. Or Arkansas, you know, or Mississippi, but, you know, it's very likely, you know, that, you know, we'll see litigation soon, you know, on a variety of different legal causes of action, you know, that are going to be determined soon. But it's just unfortunate. Again, I just want to underscore, you know, the harm that this is going to cause in the interim. You know, trans students and trans kids face extremely high rates of bullying and abuse. There was a study done just a couple of years ago that showed that over 80% of trans kids experience bullying. And, you know, we just, every time there's a bill introduced, you know, or this kind of activity in the media, we see the calls spike, you know, with the Trans Lifeline. And that's just as, you know, deeply concerning, the impact this is going to have on youth. The litigation is preparing to move forward in many different places, and we stand ready to step. We'll continue to protect trans students and trans people generally.
It's really striking that even the political fight over these issues has negative impact. The Supreme Court is a lot more conservative, of course, with the three Trump appointments and the 200 new appointments to the federal bench. So how might this affect whether you're able to get federal courts to strike down these anti-trans laws?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, we've opposed so many of the Trump administration's judicial nominees over the last 4 years because, you know, they clearly had an idea. We're clearly ideologically driven, you know, to the far right. And so many of them, you know, had made, you know, statements about trans people specifically in the past that, you know, the courts have been stacked, and so, you know, especially the circuit courts with a lot of these folks, especially the Fifth Circuit, you know, so we have to be judicious about, you know, where we bring claims and how we bring claims for sure. And that's part of why we're, you know, pleased to see the Biden-Harris administration move so quickly to begin the nomination process of fair-minded constitutionalists that are going to provide impartial justice under the law. But that is deeply concerning for sure. And that's definitely on the top of our minds when we're thinking about moving forward with these challenges.
Evelyn, we were, you know, just listening to Sasha talk about the impact that the negative impact that even the debate can have on trans folks and particularly young ones. So, I mean, have you heard from people in Arkansas who are considering leaving the state because of what's going on with these laws?
Unfortunately, I have. You know, because of, the profile that I have as being the only openly trans elected official in the state, even though I'm a local official, I have started hearing from trans people and from families of trans youth, especially. Who are really worried about all this. They don't really know what they're going to do. As we heard at the beginning, there's nothing in this law that grandfathers them in. So the care that their children are receiving now, you know, is going to be cut off if there's no legal challenge. And so they're in a very difficult situation. You know, as you heard from Sasha, young people, we've already heard, face bullying. You know, we heard from Willow who spoke to the governor about her battle over being able to use the correct restroom in her Arkansas public school. They're facing issues with access to competent healthcare. In some cases, people live in rural areas. It's a pretty rural state. And now the legislature is piling another burden on top of all of that. They're forcing these families now to, in some cases, you know, decide whether to join a legal battle on top of everything else they're facing. And it's not fair to them. It's totally wrong. You know, and we know that, as with everything else, this is going to affect trans people of color more profoundly, because they're already in a more vulnerable situation to begin with. Here in Arkansas, we've had the murders of two young trans people of color just in the last year. One of them was 17 years old. So we know that there's folks are already facing a variety of issues, and this just makes it even worse. So I have heard from people who are wondering whether they are still welcome here in Arkansas because of this string of bills.
Evelyn Rios Stafford is the Justice of the Peace for District 12 in Washington County, Arkansas. Evelyn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sasha Bookert is a senior attorney for Lambda Legal. Thanks, Sasha.
Thank you.
I'm Helga Davis, and my show is all about the art of fearless conversation.
The wonder of dialogue is that what you think is so obvious gets really questioned at a deep level.
Sometimes the truth is having those uncomfortable discussions that get to facts that we usually don't want to talk about.
Join me for a new season of Helga, wherever you get podcasts.
This week, the trial of Derek Chauvin continues. He's a former Minneapolis police officer on trial for the killing of George Floyd.
And witnesses this week continued to denounce Chauvin's actions, including Chief of the Minneapolis Police Department, Madaria Arredondo.
Once there was no longer any resistance, and clearly when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
For more on what we heard this week, we're joined by Brant Williams, a correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio News who covers public safety, criminal justice, and racial disparities. Welcome back, Brant.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
I want to start by playing another clip for you. Here's a question from the prosecutor to Lieutenant Johnny Mercil, the use of force instructor for the Minneapolis Police Department.
And so if there was, say, for example, the subject was under control and handcuffed, would this be authorized?
I would say no.
So here they're talking about, of course, it's Chauvin putting his knee on Floyd's neck. So, Brant, how significant is it to hear the testimony from all of these police officers?
Well, it sounds like it's the prosecution's goal to show jurors that even members of the Minneapolis Police Department thought that Chauvin's actions were out of bounds. Now, as you're probably aware, it's generally difficult for prosecutors to get convictions of police officers who are charged with on-duty crimes. So it may be that, you know, they're trying to show jurors that, you know, yes, cops, even though you give police officers the benefit of the doubt when they are, you know, the ones on the defense, but also you can use police officers and their experience to show that that officer as the defendant, what they did was not according to what they're trained to do.
We also heard on Monday from the emergency room doctor who tried to save Floyd's life before pronouncing him dead. What did the doctor say about the cause of death?
So Dr. Langenfeld said that while drugs like methamphetamines and fentanyl could cause a person to have a lack of oxygen, he felt that even if the paramedics had applied something like Narcan, which is used to revive people who are suffering from overdoses, he said George Floyd's heart was not displaying any ability to pulse, to pump blood on its own. And so Narcan would not have helped him.
Has the defense had anything to say about whether it was Chauvin's actions that were the cause of death?
Yes. Well, the defense has been trying to say that Chauvin was actually doing what officers are trained to do, and by holding George Floyd while they waited for paramedics to come, that was something that officers are trained to do. The defense has been trying to show has been a hostile crowd situation, and that their actions, his actions and the actions of the other officers, were in line with how officers are supposed to assess the situation. And if they feel like they are under a possible threat, perhaps from a crowd, that they need to hold their position and to have uncuffed George Floyd and to have tried to apply medical attention to him at that point. The defense is trying to show that that's something that officers have to do their own assessment of, and that perhaps they felt like they were not in a safe position to do that.
So let's hear from an expert witness the state called in, Sergeant Jody Steiger, a use of force expert at the Los Angeles Police Department.
When you reviewed the body-worn cameras, did you see anybody throw any rocks or bottles?
No, I did not.
Did you see anyone physically attack the officers?
No, I did not.
Did you hear foul language or name calling?
There was some name calling, yes, but and some foul language, but that was about the most of it.
Did that factor into your analysis?
No.
Why not?
Because I did not perceive them as being a threat.
And why is that?
Because they were merely filming, and they were, most of it was their concern for Mr. Floyd.
So this is the prosecution really going at the defense's central argument, right? They're basically laying the groundwork for being able to show the jury,
the crowd control was not enough of an issue to take the actions that they took against George Floyd.
Correct. And that was something that the state, as they were questioning their witnesses, were trying to bring out that, yes, officers face all kinds of situations and they should be prepared to do what they're supposed to do, render aid to someone who needs it, and do that even though people may be yelling at them. Again, officers are often faced in positions where they have to take somebody into custody. It's not going to look good to people who are observing. But they're trying to say that this is part of the job, and Chauvin and these other officers were trained in knowing how to do that.
And have we yet to hear any testimony that contradicts what this expert witness from Los Angeles said? That has there been anybody yet who has shed any kind of doubt on this idea that the crowd was a problem?
I think just the testimony of some of the witnesses themselves, I think that the state was trying to show that the reason why they were speaking out was they were concerned for the life of George Floyd. Even though I think Donald Williams had an exchange with Officer Tao, who was doing crowd control there, and warned him, you know, don't touch me and that sort of thing. I think the prosecution was trying to show that these people were not necessarily threatening to the officers. They were doing what they could to try to help George Floyd rather than try to intimidate the officers.
I mean, it's not looking great for the defense at the moment, but we really haven't heard their witnesses yet. So what do you expect to hear from their side?
So the defense has said at the beginning of the trial that they were going to call their own experts who will cast some doubt on the prosecution's case that George Floyd's death was primarily caused by Chauvin's use of force. They're going to have their experts talk about George Floyd's underlying medical condition. And they will likely draw some expertise from other use of force or police experts, expert witnesses, who will show that an officer in Derek Chauvin's situation was doing the right thing, doing what he was trained to do.
Now, Maurice Lester Hall, George Floyd's friend who was with him when he was killed, is trying not to testify in the trial. Why is that?
So he was in the car with George Floyd on May 25th last year. And he's a person that George Floyd's girlfriend, Courtney Ross, had testified, who had supplied George Floyd with drugs in the past. Now, in Minnesota, a person can get charged with third-degree murder if they are found to have supplied drugs to somebody who then overdoses on them. And Maurice Hall's defense attorney spoke to the court earlier this week and said he doesn't want to testify because he could incriminate himself and expose himself to a third-degree murder charge. And I imagine if you're a prosecutor, you don't want to have Maurice Hall on the stand being asked questions about drugs and drug use and have him consistently say, you know, I refuse to answer this question because I'm, you know, exercising my Fifth Amendment rights. That's something that I don't think prosecutors would like to see on the stand.
Okay. Brant Williams is a correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio News. Brant, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Following last summer's protests against police brutality, calls for civilian oversight of police became widespread in cities across the U.S. Often referred to as civilian oversight or review boards, this type of police reform allows a group of people outside of law enforcement to monitor and review police activity, including instances of misconduct or brutality. Yesterday on the show, we looked at the Civilian Oversight Board in St. Louis, Missouri, and the challenges that board has faced in holding officers accountable. It got us wondering about just how successful or effective these civilian oversight bodies actually are. For that and more, we're joined by Sharon Fairley, professor of the University of Chicago Law School and the former head of Chicago's Civilian Police Oversight Agency. Sharon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What exactly does a civilian oversight body do?
Well, there are lots of different forms of civilian oversight, but when you think about these sort of as a group, you can sort of boil down what they do into four big buckets. So the first is playing a role in the development or evaluation of policing policies and procedures. The second big bucket is involvement in the actual disciplinary process, so the process of investigating complaints of misconduct or investigating critical incidents such as use of force or officer-involved shootings. The third big bucket is helping the department be more transparent, so providing reporting, for example, on use of force incidents. And then the last piece I would call community engagement, being that liaison between the community and the department, being a forum through which community can express their concerns or interests about policing.
And what do we know about how effective these oversight bodies have been? Do they actually work?
Well, what we do know is that cities are increasingly turning to civilian oversight as an important part of police accountability systems and an important element or strategy when it comes to police reform. Now, how effective they are, sort of, you know, there's been a range, right? And even in the, even as well established as civilian oversight is, it still comes under fire time and again because it's a challenging thing to do, and it's certainly not a panacea when it comes to police accountability. It has to be part of a broader system that supports accountability writ large. But in general, you can look to this sort of the key success factors that contribute to making civilian oversight as effective as it can be. And so the first thing is that these entities must have sufficient jurisdictional scope in order to be effective. So say, for example, you have a board and all they can do is look at matters that are referred to them by the chief of police. That's not going to be very robust in terms of their ability to influence and really provide oversight. So jurisdictional scope has to be broad enough that the agency can have an impact. The second thing is resources. When we look back historically, what we see where agencies have failed, it's usually been because they didn't have sufficient resources to fulfill the mission that they've been given. And so resources are really important. And I mean financial, technical, and human, all of those. And then the third big thing is structural independence. The entity has to be able to go about its work in a way that's independent and separate from the police department. They need independent access, for example, to information and materials and reports. They need subpoena power. Transparency has also been an issue. Some of these boards have been limited in the way that they're able to talk publicly about the work that they do. And sometimes that's by choice. Sometimes that's by law. You know, for example, a collective bargaining agreement, or there may be a state law in place that prohibits them from going public with details around what they do. So that can often be a challenge. And then the last thing I would say is professionalism. And that's something that I encountered when I was doing the work. It's really important that the people who are involved in this kind of work are trained and really, you know how to do what they're doing. It's very, very difficult work. And so we need people who, you know, are trained and have the skills and experience to actually do it successfully.
You mentioned subpoena power. Yesterday, we learned that in St. Louis, none of the data and materials had been passed on from the police department to the oversight board. So that seems like a particularly critical one. Looking at these boards across the country, can you tell us, like, how many do have subpoena power?
You know, I don't have specific numbers, but what I will say is that it is a source of constant debate. When these boards are being formed, there's usually a lot of debate around this. And there's actually even some jurisdictions where it's prohibited by law. For example, in Tennessee, I think in 2019, they passed a state law that actually prohibited these civilian oversight agencies from gaining subpoena power. And this just shows you how, you know, strong the law enforcement lobby is in terms of its political power, because law enforcement is always going to be pushing back against civilian oversight. So that's where that debate comes from. But I'm seeing this, you know, the idea of agencies having subpoena power really, really accelerating just in the last 6 to 9 months in the wake of the summer protests around policing. So I think we're going to see many of these agencies being given subpoena power. For example, the state of Virginia just passed a statute that, you know, created an opportunity for those cities in that state to create civilian oversight with subpoena power.
So much of civilian oversight seems to come from either local or state at the state level. But is there a role for the federal government in this?
So, you know, the federal government, you know, has the possibility of legislating on a lot of police reform issues. The one big issue that always crops up that would be very appropriate to be addressed at the federal level is the issue of qualified immunity. But because, you know, this kind of oversight is very much about managing local law enforcement activity, it is a local phenomenon. That being said, there is the possibility through state law to help support civilian oversight and create an environment in which civilian oversight can be successful through legislative initiatives like the one I just mentioned from Virginia. Also, California, for example, just recently enacted a statute that enabled the counties of California to create civilian oversight for sheriff's departments, which is an area in which civilian oversight has been slower to gain traction just because sheriffs have their own unique political power, being able to sort of push back against civilian oversight. So state law is also an area where state law can be very helpful in creating an environment in which civilian oversight can flourish.
Sharon Fairley is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and the former head of Chicago's Civilian Police Oversight Agency. Sharon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
In the 1980s, there were around 200 lesbian bars across the U.S. They provided a dedicated place for lesbians to meet and build a sense of community, particularly as discrimination against the LGBT community was widespread. There are only about 15 lesbian bars left in existence in the U.S. today. LGBTQ bars as a whole have declined in number. The decline has been exacerbated by the pandemic. There are plenty of bars where both lesbians and gay men frequent, but today we're talking about the bars that cater exclusively to lesbians. The closures are a tough pill to swallow, particularly as there are so few spaces dedicated to this community, and losing them means losing their history. Here's what you told us about your favorite lesbian bars.
Hey, this is Kate of Iowa City. I'm so sad that my favorite lesbian bars on the West Coast, all of them, Maud's and Amelia's in San Francisco, Primary Domain and the 927 in Portland, Oregon, and the East Lake East in Seattle have all closed.
My name is Emily. I'm calling from Los Angeles. The first and last time I ever went to the iconic Lexington Club in San Francisco was their last weekend open. It was so heart-wrenching to hear the owners come up and say thank you for your support, to see the people who've been going there for decades.
Hey, this is Amber Hall, senior producer at The Takeaway. I actually met the woman who I would later marry at Ginger's in Brooklyn. These are very special, incredible places, and I really hate to see so many close their doors.
Thanks to Amber and all our listeners who reached out on this. This is also near and dear to my heart. I went to my first lesbian bar in the late 70s, a place with no windows on Portland's Skid Row. I wasn't yet 21, and even though I'd been out of the closet for a year or two at that point, I didn't know what was behind that windowless door. It turned out to be a fantastic scene, crossing generations and various representations of gender nonconformity, including working-class butch lesbians, who I wouldn't have ever seen, let alone meet otherwise. I'm joined now by Joe McDaniel, co-founder of As You Are Bar, to discuss what the continued closure of lesbian bars means for queer women and the cultural impact of these institutions. Thanks for joining me, Joe.
Thanks for having me, Nancy.
So you started bartending in DC in 2005 at LGBTQI bars and helped open DC's only standing lesbian bar, A League of Her Own. How has the scene changed in that time?
Well, it's funny how you mentioned the windowless bars in Portland Skid Row. Although DuPont Circle is far from a sketchy neighborhood, the first bar I worked in 2005 had zero notable effects on the outside. It was a completely blank space with sort of a small sign above the door. And inside was this enormous, like, warehouse-sized dance floor. Mm-hmm. And everything was painted black and everything had mirrors. And it was nothing you would expect from the outside. And that was, you know, 13 years later, I helped open A League of Her Own, which, you know, has rainbows all over the front and windows and is quite visible from the street, quite clear. The community it serves, which we didn't really, even in the early 2000s, didn't really have the freedom to do yet.
Now, let's talk about the closings. This has really been going on before the pandemic hit. So tell us, you know, what are some of the pressures on these businesses and why have there been so many closings?
Sure. Well, Washington, D.C. lost our beloved Phase One in 2015 after 41 years. Phase One was the longest running lesbian bar in the States at the time. And listening to the callers talk about the places that have closed, it was heart-wrenching. There are there are Washingtonians who still talk about the times had at Phase. I think the pressures are so many. And I think one of the main things that sort of gets swept under the rug is pay inequity and job security for queer people. Mm-hmm. You know, women and queer people and non-binary and gender non-conforming struggle to make less sense on the dollar, have less leisure money to be spending on luxury items like going out. So it just changes the need of that community. And then it changes by proxy how the proprietor can run their business. And so that's a huge pressure. And in DC, we face a lot of gentrification because we're a small area in terms of square footage or square miles rather. And so as soon as a neighborhood gentrifies or gets, you know, cleaned up, as they say, then it becomes harder to run a business there.
Can an argument be made that the need for lesbian bars has decreased as acceptance generally has increased?
I love that question because I think it's an interesting way to see how the world has shifted. And sure, we can go to a chain restaurant and potentially hold our girlfriend's hand and it be somewhat safe. But you never know what you're walking into. And in marginalized communities, that doesn't shift. You are marginalized regardless of how much acceptance. We are not there yet. And there is something incredibly sacred about walking into a space and knowing that while you don't know what's behind that door, you know that it's your people in there. And you know that there's a commonality that you can't find just anywhere. And there's that safety helps you grow and become the human you're going to be when you know you have it. So as somebody who, you know, started in my early 20s and I'm now in my late 30s and have watched the bar scene shift from behind the bar, I can tell you that there are 22-year-olds today who are still aching. So I don't think we're aging out. They're still aching for that sense of community that we can only get in spaces that are designed for our community.
Right. So you and your co-founder are working to open As You Are Bar in Washington, D.C. So tell us about that project and what you're trying to do with it.
Yeah, I think gay bars generally have a fairly cookie cutter approach, and we're looking to break that mold. Rach Pike and I are looking to be more inclusive, to not be a lesbian bar, but to be able to use a more umbrella term like queer to really make sure we're including trans folks and non-binary folks. And then we're looking to sort of bridge some of the age gap. DC has a huge higher education component, and if you're not 21, there's really no place for you yet. And we want to change that.
Are there different dynamics in place for LGBTQ bars as a whole? I mean, their numbers are declining as well, but is there anything different going on between lesbian bars and the more general queer bars in general?
Yeah, I think that the sort of the gay men community really builds its nightlife or builds its social component around where people go. Whereas for what I have found in the community of queer women and non-binary people and trans folks is that we are going to go where the people are. So it's not so much about what space we go to, but who we're occupying it with. And so that just seems to be like almost inherently a difference between the communities in that regard. And I think that as we as a community have more equality, the dwindling numbers in gay men bars has shifted. And I think that's a generational thing. You know, there was a bit of a dip in the 80s when the AIDS epidemic ran rampant through our community. And I think it's almost like an opposite effect happened, that once we started getting more legal rights, almost our community sort of started settling down and going out a little bit less or needing that community as our visibility increased a little less.
Well, there's also the advent of online dating, online hookups, which has been, you know, that's a huge shift in how you meet people, because of course, mm-hmm. it doesn't need to be said, when that didn't exist, you almost had to go to the bars to find people to meet.
Yeah, there was no other option, yeah.
Right. So, you know, obviously the pandemic has been brutal on bars and restaurants, but do you think there might be an actual bump once we're able to reopen? I mean, it seems like if there ever was a case for pent-up demand, this would be one of them.
Yeah, it's so interesting. So Rach, my partner, and I, when we founded As You Are Bar, we provide a good amount of virtual content. We have weekly content and, you know, monthly things. And while people are very grateful and continuously like sort of cheer us on in that, the countdown is real. The constant asking of when a brick and mortar is coming. It just happens continuously. And something we spoke about early in pandemic is the service industry has shifted a little bit because this generation didn't know how much they needed us or how much they were gaining from having, you know, nightlife professionals in their lives until we were not there. So Rach and I in particular have gotten, because we were both bartending up until the pandemic hit and well into it, we got lots of messages about like, I'm like literally shock and awe. I can't believe how much I miss you all, how much I miss being in that space. Even people who were sort of like, not into it or crammed in or uncomfortable. It was like, no, I'm dying to be like on a sweaty dance floor. And we get it because we do too.
That's like me actually missing my commute to work, which is crazy.
Right.
along with lesbian bars, black owned gay bars have also seen their numbers decline. What do we collectively lose when these spaces close?
Safety, first and foremost. I think we're so fortunate to the pandemic for a lot of people's eyes being opened to the white supremacist and capitalist structure that we're built on. It was really easy when you were sort of in the rat race of ambition to lose sight of that bigger picture. And I think so many people have less of an ability to ignore those truths anymore. And so when you lose your community, the more intersectional, the better. There was this Monday party here in DC that Rach and I would frequent, and it was held in a bar owned by a Black woman, and it was run by all Black queer people. And we just went into add money to the pot and not take up too much space, but just to help help keep the parting going. And yeah, people meet each other, they network, and there's power in that. There's power in numbers. And so knowing where your people are going to be on a certain given night, that just keeps you safe through the rest of the week. It's better for your mental health. It's better, you know. So I just think losing spaces, particularly those owned by marginalized communities, anytime one person loses or has to close their doors, it's a blow to that whole community.
Right. I think it's hard sometimes for people who've lived their whole lives as heterosexuals to really understand the role that bars have played in the lives of gays and lesbians over the years, for more than a century, really. So towards the end of last year, two filmmakers started the Lesbian Bar Project, which is trying to raise money for lesbian bars to stay open. How is that going? And you know, is it playing a role in preserving the bar scene?
Well, Erica Rose and Alina Street, I can't say enough good things about these incredibly ambitious, super young humans. I've been very fortunate to work really closely with them both on the first iteration of Lesbian Bar Project, as well as what they have coming up. And, you know, I got to flirt with Leah Delaria on via Zoom for an event, but that's, you know, no surprise there. Anyone within 100-mile radius ever gets that. But so that was really fun. It's one of the biggest things for me that was a takeaway of that was interacting with proprietors of the different spaces across the country and sort of learning people's stories. You can feel really siloed because, again, misogynistic culture says that we should be competitors. So we don't really like talk to and about each other that often. And I have been fortunate enough to just fall in love with these people who are also doing this work in their small, and it feels so small when you're in it, just in your little bar in your little town, which none of our towns are particularly small, but still that's how it feels. And like to actually just like sit and throw ideas back and forth and tell our stories is so powerful. Lisa Canastrassi, who owns Henrietta Hudson's, is absolutely like my elder crush for a year now, because she's, you know, everything you want in a New York broad with this like scratchy, raspy smoker's cough voice and thick New York accent. She's just my hero. And so, you know, it's an impressive thing when we know about each other and when we can hold each other up and hang on to each other.
I guess that is one of the silver linings in the pandemic cloud, is that the ways that Zoom has allowed people to be in touch across geographical distance, at least. Jo McDaniel is the co-founder of As You Are Bar, coming soon to Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I first started going to dyke bars because I was a lesbian, and that was a place to meet other women. It was very exciting. But I kept going because I loved to dance. And the first dyke bar I went to was Dietrich's, I think it was called, named after Marlene Dietrich. And then places like the Duchess. I was able to sit in the back in a corner and watch sort of the dynamics between women, because I was a baby dyke and had so many questions but was so scared to ask. I moved on to Crazy Nannies. There being two floors was so great. I was always on the dance floor on the top when I wasn't trying to do naughty things in the bathrooms. I moved on to the Click Club and loved it there, but also Henrietta Hudson's, which actually was super small, so wasn't really my fave spot. But before COVID, on a Friday night, you would see me in Henrietta's sweating it out on the dance floor. I think the reason why dyke bars are so important and why it's so sad that they're a dying breed is because where do you go, you know, to see dykes?
in a big group, in a clump, you know, like nowhere else except for maybe the Dyke March. And that's only once a year. So Dyke March, I mean, Dyke bars are super important. I am a Black lesbian and my age, 55.
Hi, my name is Lauren. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm 36 years old. Growing up in Park Slope, I've always been blessed to have lesbian bars there as far back as I can remember. They've always been a place of empowerment for me. Aside from just being a place to hang out with your friends, it's a place where we have community meetings and social events outside of just drinking. And like any marginalized community, it's important for people to have access to safer spaces where they know that they'll be welcomed and free to be themselves. So it's important for these lesbian bars to continue to exist. Specifically in Park Slope, Ginger's on Fifth Avenue pretty much raised me. When I was in my early 20s, I used to go to Caddyshack on Fourth Avenue. That since has closed. And then when I would go to the city, I would often go to Cubbyhole in the Village.
Okay, that was fun. We appreciate you all reaching out and telling us about your favorite lesbian bars and what it meant to you. Anytime you want to talk with us, you can just go to thetakeaway.org and click on Contact Us. You can record your take right from your computer or phone. And you can use the old-fashioned phone as well, 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Nancy Solomon in for Tanzina, and this is The Takeaway.